Philosophers.
Philosophers. So, David,
Have you ever been in a circumstance that wasn't that bad?
but you thought it was?
Yes.
I think that's what we're going to talk about today. When an individual finds themselves in a situation that they believe to be way more severe than in all actuality it really is. And we're kind of working with the title hyperbolic circumstances. So let's talk about what we're talking about and maybe try to define what a hyperbolic circumstance is.
Sure.
So I would like to propose the working definition that a hyperbolic circumstance is one in which the individual or group of individuals is under a different understanding than what is actually occurring.
Or perhaps consider the circumstances to be far more dire than they actually are.
Yes, I think because what I had
Because
said leads it to
it
both.
seems always to be negative as well.
Right. I do think it might be worth our time to look at the general case, though, because there are certain times when individuals are in a circumstance that they perceive as being not that bad when they actually are, but that is a lot more, I feel, a rarer occurrence. That's a rarer
Right.
phenomena
Well,
than the
and we
other.
actually do have a word for that. It's called downplaying
Yes.
or excessive optimism, that kind of thing. But I
Right.
wouldn't say that all these negative hyperbolic circumstances are necessarily pessimistic either.
Sure.
It's more like a panic than pessimism.
Which I guess that's kind of what we're talking about is panic. I guess that's what we're talking about when we're talking about a hyperbolic circumstance.
Yes.
But I do think that there is a like it, there's incipient panic that isn't quite yet a panic that we're
Right,
also
someone
covering
is
as well.
still acting well in a rational way according to their feelings,
Yes. So,
as opposed to a full-blown panic, which tends to involve no reason whatsoever.
exactly. So, let's do our due diligence on the what we believe to be the less frequent but opposite of the of ensuing panic, and that is not really lethargy, but I don't know how you would, I guess, how did you frame it earlier?
Downplaying
Downplaying, yeah.
circumstances.
The positive side of delusional.
Yeah, what about it?
I think these things do happen. And
Sure.
I think one of the only times this is maybe a dangerous circumstance is when let's take our free society example we always like to talk about, and we're going to lay out a 10 by 10 grid of 1 mile squares. So we have 100 1 mile square plots of land,
Okay.
and on each of these lives a person. Well, the person in cell 1-1 is undergoing some kind of threat from, or is threatening his immediate neighbors in such a way that they feel very threatened, and it is actual. It's an actual threat. Well, the further removed from the origin you get, the less
Urgent.
urgent it feels to everyone else. And
Yep.
so, while rationally they would see this as a threat, because if it spreads, it will become a worse problem for me by that time. It is not immediate. Therefore, I would tend to downplay the circumstances of, what's going on. Like, can you believe guy that lives in 1-1 is threatening to annex every all of his neighbor's land and then conscript them into an army and build a new nation state? Well, if I live at the origin 0-0, I'm like, nah, that's far away. I don't need to worry about that. It doesn't affect me, not my
Right.
problem, And it isn't that person's problem until it's too late, when half the board has been taken over by this individual, and now they are essentially snowballing towards you, and the problem is way bigger than it was if everyone would have stepped in at the beginning, right? I think that's one of the only negative ways this can happen on a societal level, but on an individual level, you see people do this, I think, all the time with illnesses. People will you know, insist that they are not ill or sick, or, you know, it's just some pain in my side, or it's, oh, I just sneeze a lot.
Yep.
And they don't take care of it until it becomes a life-threatening problem, which it that by that time is typically much more expensive to deal with a lot of the time, but also perhaps has a higher probability of further complications at that point.
It's just a little spider bite until necrosis sets in and you're in real trouble.
And you're in real trouble, exactly. So, but I feel like, while that is a problem, I feel that it is worse when people go to the other way, where people become deranged, if you will, about an incipient problem, what they see to be an incipient problem. One of these you see a lot, I think, is you see it a lot happen around tribalism, where if a group finds one commonality between their opposition group and an even worse group from maybe an historical period, they will tend to synonymize everything with that group. And the most popular one right now is, you know, what does it mean to be a Nazi in 2019, as opposed to what it meant to be a Nazi in 1939. You know, well, both of these places, you know, believed in their nation. So they were both nationalistic. So if all it takes is to be nationalistic for you to be the same. And people mentally snowball that and conflate the two things. Right. That's an example.
Right.
To the point where you call them the same. And I do feel like there's also something to be said in the negative case, which isn't so much present in the positive case, and that is the self-fulfilling prophecy nature of it, where if you fight against a phantom enemy long enough, you may actually find one, or you may actually create one. You know, that's another thing. That might be a different topic, but...
Yeah, I think there is a totally different topic about, like, lurking extremists or, you know, the what do I want to call it? The like the fringe mm-hmm. of groups. Yeah.
So I feel like both of these, I think both ends of the spectrum contribute to escalation in general. One, however, allows for escalation by leaving it open to other people to escalate, whereas the other is you actively escalating. I think that's one of the biggest differences between the two. And I don't believe that you can be held responsible for allowing someone else to escalate a situation necessarily. But you can be held responsible for escalating a situation, even if that doesn't come down to an actual, you know, conviction or anything like that. I think, you know, socially, human beings can recognize when someone is escalating a situation. And, you know, we see it all the time where someone, like, you see two people arguing. Well, the first person to go from a civil disagreement to shouting is seen as the aggressor and the person who is escalating the incident. And we will tend to see the other person as justified to return in kind. But anytime either party escalates, you know, if you go from a disagreement to a yelling argument to physical violence, whoever it is the first to move to the next level is usually the person everyone sees in the wrong. So I do think there is something to be said that socially human beings detest unnecessary escalation, which I do think most of the time escalation is seen as unnecessary. Not always, I would say, but I do think a lot of the time it is more difficult to convince someone that it was just for you to escalate a situation when a potential solution could have been reached without escalation. You know, a lot of people, if you look in the government, you know, the state level, most people will think that the first state to enter into, you know, to break negotiations and escalate things to a cold war or cold status is seen as the person who escalates, for example, and things like that. Most people, I feel like, want to see any disagreement resolved peacefully and civilly. I would say most people want that. I mean, would you disagree?
No. I mean, yeah. It, well, aside from, you know, warmongers, but those are not a majority. So yes, I can go along with most people want something to be resolved peacefully.
So the problem, I feel like, with hyperbolic circumstances or people when they are nearing a panic is that the real problem you see is people feel justified in escalating things, or they feel as though things have already been escalated and thus are justified in entering to the new level themselves.
Right. Like, you know, if you have two people, you know, or you know, maybe a couple in a relationship, and one of them says something that they know will be taken deeply offensively by the other, then the other one will feel justified in escalating to a shouting match.
Right.
You know,
I do think
they, to them, shouldn't have gone there, so to speak.
It's like, you should know not to do that.
Right.
You know, and you could maybe make the argument that the person who made the deeply offensive comment in the context of a relationship, if they knew it would invoke that sort of reaction, you could, I think, justifiably allege that that person escalated first. But that's kind of getting into the subjectivity realm, which, again, a lot of this is subjective because we're talking about feels, you know? But in a sweeping society, especially in the modern day when we can communicate with people who we do not share a lot of cultural similarities, and this can even exist within a nation, you know, like for easily exist within a nation, you know, people in the United States, for example, we live in an area of the United States where, you know, people who live on coasts from us are actually, I would say that there are people in other countries that are more culturally similar to us than we are with people that live in urban coastal environments. However, now we can communicate as though we live right next door to one another.
Right.
And so they can say something that to them is not hyperbolic or to them is not offensive, whereas to people here, it would come across that way. And it's those, and it could be that these are the, and I think these are always growing pains when you have people of two significantly different cultural groups come into contact with one another. Granted, a lot of the time this happens a lot more slowly, and I feel like cultures tend to trade customs and kind of even out after a while. In nature, like, you know, let's take it back 50,000 years. If there are two tribes of people that enter into trade, usually they're not, and if they're not adjacent to one another, it's only one or two people. You know, it's a small group of people going back and forth, and they begin essentially trading the culture as well. Like, one person might show up and say, oh, well, in our custom, we do this. And if everyone there thinks it's a good idea, they might start doing it too. The most prominent way you see these things happen is what happens when people from the separate cultures have children together. Well, those children are going to, can't, if there are any conflicting cultural practices, they can't adopt both. And so oftentimes they will adopt either full from one side, or they will, even more frequently, I feel like, blend the two. And after, over time, as generations move forward, the cultures kind of blend into a new superculture. And that's, and that's something I think we see happen, that's happened all throughout human history. I'm not an anthropologist, but I think that's something that is pretty common sense that most people would see. But now it's almost instantaneous. You know, say we were to reach out to an undocumented tribe of people, and within one generation, that tribe could have the internet and their kids could be talking to people of all of other very, very different cultures. And it's more of a, instead of it being a one to, it's more of a one-to-one kind of exchange at that point. And so what I'm trying to get to with all of this is, I feel like that's how people can enter into this circumstance where they take things hyperbolically is, you know, when I see people masking up and protesting, that's something very different than what I'm used to. The only time I see people who mask up when it's not cold outside anyway, those people are almost always up to no good. You know what I mean? Like, if I were to see a group of people entering a building with black masks on and holding weapons, I would assume that they were going to commit a crime, because that's typically the only time you see that. Like, why else would you mask up if not to conceal your identity?
Because you're about to do something that you don't want associated with you.
Exactly. But there are plenty of other cultures where it is considered impolite to show your full face to other people, for example, or that is considered intimate in the same way that we do not reveal certain parts of our body to just passersby most of the time. So my cultural expectations of what is acceptable behavior or not, when immediately confronted with that, is these people are up to no good. And so I feel justified in perhaps
escalating,
or like, to go back to that example, I'm in my neighborhood gun store, and I carry, and I'm looking to purchase a firearm or whatever. And I look across the street, and there's a jeweler, and I see people put on balaclavas and black jackets, and they're holding, like, sticks and stuff, and they, you know, backpacks and everything, and combat-looking gear, whatever, you know, all black, and they go inside as a group. I would feel justified in calling the police, but also feel as though I needed to alert everyone in my surroundings that, hey, everyone, I just saw this. And if we are all of the similar culture, we're all going to feel like that is a bad thing. We would also feel like it's our responsibility as good neighbors to make sure everything was okay. So me and everyone in the gun store, minus maybe the proprietor, take our guns next door to the jewelry store, and we walk in with guns. And at that point, the tensions are already insanely high, where even a nonchalant act, like if I were to hear a loud noise or something like that, might set something off, you know. And it's I think those are the situations we're talking about. So you can innocently come into this situation, but how do we deal with these kind of situations when you're in them? And I would argue that you can't really know that you're in this kind of situation most of the time, because by the nature of you entering the situation, I feel like you have to be ignorant of some facts of reality to even enter it. Would you agree?
You have to be ignorant of some facts of reality to enter into that situation.
Right. Like, for example, for me to enter into a situation in which I am wrongfully prepared to escalate. Like in the case of this example of the jewelry store, if this group of people were just from this other country I'd never heard of, and I wasn't aware, I'm ignorant that this is actually normal for them. It's not normal for me.
Okay, so you're okay, I guess I missed we're asserting that the people who walked in with masks and clubs are not there to rob the store.
Yes, that, because if they were there to rob a store, then it by definition, maybe it's not a hyperbolic circumstance. It is a justified circumstance for me to do that. But I can't know their intentions. Right. I think that's what we're getting at, is you can't know the intentions of other people. We have to assume a lot of the time.
Yes.
And so by making a negative assumption, I enter into a hyperbolic circumstance compared to reality. They are just there to buy jewelry because it's cheaper in America, and they're going to go back home and they want to give their wives and husbands or whatever something nice to remember the trip by. I am ignorant to, A, this type of dress being a custom to anyone, and not only that, but I'm also ignorant about this group of people. But because I don't like dying and I'm a human, I'm always going to assume a threat for my own safety. That's part of human psychology we discussed time and time again.
Yes.
And so now, I guess the question I would have is, am I in the wrong for acting out of ignorance in that case? Being willing to escalate the situation at that point, you know?
I think in this particular situation, there are some more variables at play. For instance, there could be something said about the fact that you just put yourself into a situation where you had assumed from the beginning would have the distinct possibility of resulting in a fight. And so should you have even put yourself in that situation when it wasn't your problem?
And that's fair, you know. And that's what I'm trying to get at, is what could we do to avoid these type of hyperbolic circumstances? Because I'm going to go ahead and say it, you know, a lot of people's response to the formation of Antifa, especially now, is this most people involved in Antifa are in a, I would say, hyperbolic circumstance. And they have chosen to move into action for it and get involved in something they see as their responsibility.
Yes.
And I can empathize to some degree, you know, because if I believed that I lived in a state that was
being taken over by communists
or even fascists,
or, well, yeah, that's true. Actual
any type
fascists.
Of authoritarianism, I would feel it is my responsibility to reject that oncoming system and to insurrect at some point, you know, and that's a different, and that's kind of what we were going to talk about, you know, at some point, you know, the, you know, what was it called?
Last resorts
is, when do you escalate to that place where essentially you're willing to put your life on the line for something? We kind of talked about it before, point of no return, I think, or something like that. We had called it. I can't remember.
Sure.
I don't think it was a full episode either. I think we just kind of casually talked about it. But when you're in a hyperbolic circumstance, you feel as though you're already there, but you're not. You know, people outside of the circumstance may be able to look in and say, this isn't that. And so how do we avoid these situations? And one thing that you had brought up is we should, if everyone operated under the principle of mind your own business and stay out of it, would that cut down on these type of circumstances? And the scenario I gave, perhaps I see people go into this store and I'm like, that's sketchy.
This may not end well.
Not my problem.
But it's not my place to go in there and settle it.
Yeah. It's so I'm going to just go about my day and move along, you know, but is that okay?
Well, in a situation like that, I mean, honestly, I advise people to think that way, especially if they're carrying weapons.
Yes.
Because that's a good way to get yourself into legal trouble, to put yourself into a violent situation that, even if they really were there to go rob that store, to put yourself in that situation can get you into legal trouble.
Right.
Because it's going to seem, in front of a jury, like you were trigger happy. You wanted to shoot somebody.
You were looking for a problem.
Yes.
Yes. And I do tend to agree. There is something to be said. And I do think that's kind of goes hand in hand why with a lot of people who claim to be libertarians or anarchists or whatever, there's a strong streak of self-reliance that goes along with it. And I think that's necessary because in order to exist in a society like that, we all need to be prepared to... We all need to be living under the idea that we mind our own business to avoid these kinds of circumstances. But because in that same, if we all thought that way, well, the guy who ran the jewelry store, he needs to know that if someone does come in with guns or sticks or whatever, if someone does come to wrong you,
we're not coming over there to help you.
We're not coming over there to help you.
We'll sell you a gun so you can handle it.
Exactly. And so, if you live in a society in which most people are self-reliant, or all people, it would be the goal, are self-reliant, then if I hear gunshots going on down the street, it's like, that sounds like a place I don't want to be. And
I will go the other way.
I do think that kind of runs counter to a lot of what people would do, though, actually.
Well, yes. Well, it depends on how you see yourself. If someone sees themselves as, you know, some sort of, I don't necessarily want to use the word hero, but...
Brother's keeper is what I would say.
Sure.
That's a term you see a lot in a lot of religious contexts anyway.
Sure. Or, well, I've heard people throw around the term like sheepdog or those kind of people who are basically like, you know, well, it's a special type of elitism, really.
It really is.
But yeah, those type of people who feel that basically it's their duty to intervene in situations like that. But the problem is, exactly as you said, it's ignorance. They have no way of knowing what's actually going down.
Right.
You know, well, and it's the classic case of, okay, there is a, you are in a parking lot and you hear a gunshot. And so you, the sheepdog, move in to check it out. Okay. And you hear, the fighting appears to continue. And then suddenly you peek around a car and you see somebody holding a pistol and, you know, looking over vehicles, trying to see where somebody else is to shoot them. Well, which person are you looking at? Are you looking at the aggressor or the victim? So how do you know whether to shoot? Because if it's the aggressor, you want to shoot them and stop the confrontation. But if it's not, or perhaps it's another sheepdog like you who is also trying to check out the situation, you end up shooting one another. It's, you know, it's just a bad idea
mm-hmm.
to get involved in somebody else's fight.
Right. I totally agree. I do think there is something to be said, though, that I do think this might be one of those prerequisites to a free society, is that people have a common cultural understanding that you stay out of it, or to act rationally, because realistically that's what we're talking about is
right. If you don't know what's going on and there's fighting,
you stay away. Stay away. Yeah. Now I will say there is something to be said, though, in one way this changes entirely is if you are, it doesn't change entirely, but it does change the dynamic of the situation. In let's use your scenario. So you, the sheepdog, hear someone yell for help.
Mm.
Now, in a world in which no one lies, you would assume the victim is calling out for help.
Sure.
But people lie, and especially in situations in which their life feels threatened. So you round the corner, and you're peeking over cars, and you see a guy sitting there, and he notices you and says, "Help me, this guy's trying to kill me." Nothing's really changed, though.
No.
You still do not have the facts of the situation.
Right, and are you about to shoot somebody because somebody else just said, "Hey, he's trying to kill me."
Because the thing is, maybe this guy who's asking for help was the aggressor,
right,
but got himself into something that he doesn't want to be in anymore.
Yep. And now he's going to enlist the help of you, the helpful bypasser, I guess.
Yep.
Helpful TM.
Yeah. I mean, you are being helpful to
somebody.
Somebody. Exactly. And so that's, you know, I think that's another reason specifically that freedom of speech in this case is important, you know, is because
I think this happens in less consequential settings as well. You know, it doesn't have to happen in a life-threatening situation. You know,
absolutely
you can
not.
Have, you know, suppose you're out in a bar with your friends and suddenly you hear a woman shout for help, and you look over at the bar because you're sitting at a table. You look over at the bar and you see a man who's grabbed this woman's wrists and he's visibly angry. Well, it's very easy to jump to a conclusion that, oh, he's aggressing her and we need to go stop him and beat him up or something, or otherwise restrain him anyway. But you don't know why he's grabbing her wrists. She might have been swinging at him.
Mm-hmm. You don't know. And in a... Okay, that's fair. Now, there is one... I can already hear people saying, well, the first goal of all third parties that choose to become involved, and that's the key here, is if you believe that people should get involved, most people, I would think, is the first goal is to stop whatever is happening. Essentially isolate all parties, and then we can de-escalate the situation and
yep.
resolve it with words.
Yes.
So you could still intervene, and they would probably say, why don't you intervene, separate them, even if forcefully, and then hear both sides and essentially have a small social tribunal right there in the bar above who did what, and then you as the now group of people in the bar, and don't be wrong, properly the owner of the bar should be the one who decides what happens. And really the only thing that could happen is people being asked to leave, you know, so he or she gets to make the decision on who gets kicked out essentially. But in order to get to that point, people would say you need to de-escalate the situation first. What do you think about that that course of action instead of people just looking over and going, not my problem.
I think that de-escalation is the best possible outcome of an escalated situation. The problem then depends on the scenario. Just how possible is it to de-escalate without having to make a very important and dangerous decision about whether you use deadly force against somebody.
Right.
Yeah. Well, like pulling this hypothetical couple apart is not a deadly encounter, or it shouldn't be.
Right.
You don't know if one of them is going to pull out a knife when you try to restrain them, but, you know, whatever.
I would argue, however, I'm going to make an argument here that there is no way. Okay, if two people, let's say the man and the woman in this case, they enter into an escalated altercation, there is no way you can de-escalate it without escalating it first. Because by merely adding more participants, you are in escalating.
That is correct.
The occurrence.
Yep.
And I think that I'm not sure what that means, whether that's good or bad, because I would tend to say it is always wrong to escalate the situation. And you, especially if you don't know any of these people and you are not beholden to any of them, it is not your responsibility. And in fact, you are stepping outside of your responsibility to enter into the situation unprovoked, directly. And you are escalating the situation regardless of your intentions. Now, I can see how in a majority of circumstances, it's worth the escalation to achieve de-escalation. I totally understand that that is something that has to happen.
I think really the threshold to avoid crossing here is deadly force, really. Because, you know, if you are escalating a situation to grab somebody and physically restrain them, like, in all likelihood, aside from some extreme anomalous situations, you're not going to permanently damage them by doing this.
Sure.
It's fine. And then, you know, the worst thing that could happen here is that as you attempt to restrain them, then they escalate again. As mentioned before, they try to pull a weapon to keep you from restraining them.
Hmm. Okay. Well, in that case, let me raise the situation again, because I do think this is kind of also what we're talking about. You, by escalating, can incur a hyperbolic circumstance because, and I'm not saying that you should tiptoe around trying not to.
Well, yes. Yeah. I definitely see what you're saying because, you know, let's say that you are the man in the situation and she was really swinging at you and you're just trying to defend yourself. And then suddenly a bunch of other men in the bar stand up and start approaching you and you're wondering what's about to happen to you from what they just saw. You know, then your mind immediately goes to the worst. But, you know, oh, they're about to kick the shit out of me.
Or what's even worse is I'm about to be restrained and perhaps even have some posse justice carried out on me at this point. And you may legitimately feel that I am sufficiently outnumbered and my life is threatened at this time.
Yep.
And you don't have the luxury of being able to confer with these people. So you draw your firearm to prevent yourself from entering into a situation in which you cannot come back from. So say you are, because if you get detained, even temporarily, you are no longer in control of your person.
Yep. And you're also extremely vulnerable.
And you're extremely vulnerable. And so you might feel the necessity to draw a firearm. And I would say that rationally, that's probably not a bad idea. You know, I'm not saying we should live in a society in which at the drop of a hat, everyone pulls a gun. But, that's the true difficult part is if everyone were to be armed, is there any way the first person that pulls their gun isn't the first person dead? Like, that's kind of, you know, that's the joke that you hear a lot about in Texas where it's like, well, what's to keep people with guns from just drawing their guns? I'm like, what's everyone else with a gun? Because even if you're not in the wrong, even if you're in the right to defend yourself, if you pull a gun in a crowded area where there are a bunch of other people with guns, you just threatened everyone else by pulling a firearm. And you put them in the exact same situation that you were in, that you felt like you needed to be. So, and that's how you, and I don't know if that kind of circumstance is one that falls under the category of that's a rare event. If we were to live in a society in which most people carried firearms for their self-defense, you know, because I could see the claim that that guy pulls his firearm and everyone else who is not being pointed at is like, oh, time for me to leave. You know, like our first reaction should be to, disengage, essentially. Like, I'm going to exit the situation because I have an opportunity to at this time and I should take it. I don't know. But then again,
there's also psychology to contend with here.
Yes.
Because I can definitely imagine that anyone who is in a position to will say, you know, oh dear, someone is about to be shot. I should tackle this person before he can get a shot off.
It's one of those things where it's amazing to me that human beings are able to de-escalate a situation like this.
because when you analyze it rationally, if you put it in a rational context and also have as your axiom that people will assume the worst about everything, it just seems like every time anything is escalated ever, it should just end in everyone dying. Like,
yeah. It's like, oh, shit. Like, just one person pulls a gun, everyone who is within 10 yards of somebody who is also within 10 yards of somebody else leading away from the epicenter in a chain is about to die, you know? Essentially is what's about to happen, you know? It's hard not to see how that happens. But I do think our human psychology provides us alternatives here as well. You know, most people tend to also give benefits of doubt as well. And that's a part of human psychology. But I do think
I think we're also ignoring, you know, that we'll stick with the same circumstances. The man in this case, who is being approached by other men attempting to restrain him, could shout before they arrive, "She was attacking me. She was assaulting me."
Or he could unhand her and just
throw his hands in the air
and make the most non-threatening gesture he can. And he could cave immediately to the room, and most people probably won't.
Right.
If he already will
de-escalate.
Yes.
Yes.
Under social pressure at that point. And never underestimate human pressure, because it's the same thing that gets us both in and out of these type of hyperbolic situations is social pressure, I feel like. And I do think in a society, especially in one that we remove any type of law enforcement, there will always be social enforcement. That's something that we will not be able to escape. And I do think that there's something to be said about letting that be the vehicle by which we regulate ourselves in a society. Because especially if you contend that social pressure is not violence and not violation of the NAP, which I don't think it is. And I think most libertarians would agree that social pressures are not violations of the NAP.
No, they're just influences.
They are influences. If they are just social, they are always nonviolent. They're always non-forceful. So I do think that we can get around it there. But I would want to entertain the unrealistic circumstance of a society in which everyone kind of culturally agrees to the let's just not my problem everything. So in the same circumstance, in the bar, when someone decides to escalate, no one else gets up. No one else intervenes. So now the issue stays between the two people having the dispute. In the event of, well, the man who is just defending himself is defending himself, he has already done that. You know, in the scenario you laid out, he has, you know, restrained the person attacking him and can choose to deal with the situation by disengaging the person at that point at a safe distance.
Or calling for help if he feels like it's necessary.
He could call for help. Or he could...
Well, then again, I guess, well... This does really go back to the issue of someone calling for help. Because in our original scenario, the woman had called for help.
Right, but...
And in this situation, she would be, you know, falsely calling for help.
Right, but even then, okay, in the context we had already laid out in a bar... There is another person who does have responsibility in this scenario. The proprietor does. So regardless, if she calls for help, and a request for help is no one's business, unless you choose to make it your business. But in this type of culture we've laid out, everyone's kind of like, not my business. It's not directly affecting me, and I don't stand to benefit. until an offer is made. So I'm not going to, if they say, help me and I'll pay you, then I might be, you know, motivated, but, or whatever. And don't be wrong, there's always like the human psychological. It's like, what could I potentially get out of the situation? But the person who is by default also a part of this is the proprietor of the establishment.
Yep.
So if a person calls for help, they will arrive to, you would think, resolve the dispute. And at this point, that person has authority in the room.
That, right.
Well, not only authority.
Presumably in a society like this, they would probably have hired security and things like that, whose job it would be to de-escalate the situation.
Right. Or you probably wouldn't even need
hired
security.
And that would actually probably get around the problem of the man feeling threatened at everyone in the room standing up to de-escalate. If you see somebody in a uniform walk up, you assume that they're there to de-escalate the situation. They're not there to hurt you.
Right, because they stand to
lose. And they're not going to drag you out back and beat you up, because that's not their job.
Exactly. And that doesn't bode well for anybody at that point. Even, you know, no one. So I think that's one way we can deal with it, is that it's not my responsibility to intervene, and I'm not going to, because by intervening, I escalate the situation. Now, the thing is, does that mean that it is immoral for you to escalate a situation or not? I mean, I think under the what we discussed earlier and just how human psychology is, most people would say no, it's moral for you to intervene. You know, that's, I think that's a more common belief right now, is that people are like, no, it's our responsibility to intervene. And I can list the multitude of times that that has happened, and we were way worse off for it. Everyone involved was worse off for it. So why is that a thing, you know? And I'm not going to sit here and lament all humanity and say that we are flawed necessarily, and I'm not going to throw certain groups of people under scrutiny for it, but I do think that they play a part in propagating this belief that it is our responsibility. Most religions, anyway, especially Western religions, are definitely at fault. For propagating the belief that it is your responsibility to be beholden to others, you know. And I'm looking at you, Christianity, Judaism, and even Islam. The Abrahamic religions all are responsible for this. And you could make the argument that there are a handful of Eastern religions that aren't, that hold as a tenet isolation and non-interference. But a majority of religions, I feel like, hold a, we should care about each other. And that's where it comes from, is it's the same thing that makes us want to care about each other and help each other that also ends up getting us into a lot worse off circumstances. And I'm curious, and I want to entertain the thought. Are we good to move and entertain a new thought, or have we left anything uncovered at this point?
Let's go ahead.
Okay. Cause I think we've pretty much beaten that situation by this. You could guess where we're going to go anywhere else from that. You can add little nuances or whatever, but it's not going to change the core belief. So in a prehistoric society for humans, the idea of being self-sufficient is laughable, because human beings in solitary are not self-sufficient in nature.
There's a reason why we are social, and it's because the ones who weren't social died.
Yes, exactly. There's a reason the other however many species of human there were, a lot of them aren't around anymore. And we tended to be the most social, and we lived, so it worked out for us. Now, I would make the claim that have we technologically progressed to the point that we have out invented our biology in this case?
No, I don't think so.
You don't think so?
Well, okay. I guess it depends on what you mean technically. So the technology exists such that we have gotten ourselves into a situation where someone can get a job and pay for things to become self-sufficient.
Okay, I see what you're saying. Okay.
But the problem is that we still rely on other people for getting the things that we need to do that.
Right. Okay, so let me reverse the situation. Not so much technologically as in inventions. I guess that's the wrong word. But have we, do you think, come up with systems that remove the human individual direction of helping one another. Let me clarify.
What do you mean? Yeah.
Let me clarify. Okay, so how did human beings socially work together prehistorically to survive?
I don't know. There's no history.
There's no history. But okay, historically then, like 50,000 years ago, human beings got along socially enough to survive. Don't get me wrong. I know humans...
history 50,000 years ago, but anyway.
More than that. Whatever. I don't...
Okay. How do people get along to survive?
Yes.
It depends on where they were.
It does, to some degree. But a lot of it...
Hunter-gatherer societies, which organize themselves...
Okay, but did they organize themselves so much, or were they organized by someone? Like,
organized by someone.
Like, for example,
Well, like the concept of a leader...
Hierarchical society, yes. This is what I'm essentially trying to get at, is... And this will happen today. And a great example is, if you put 50 people, lock them in a compound together, and you let them sit long enough, and you provide them all of the ability to generate what they would need to be self-sufficient, but it would require work. And this is something that ANCAPs and ANCOMs disagree on all the time, but fact of the matter is, someone's going to become the leader. Someone's going to take charge. And there might be more than one person that tries to be that person. A conflict will generally ensue, and it doesn't always have to be physical, but contention will rise, and then eventually equilibrium will be achieved, or everyone will die. Like, that's essentially what you're going to end up with if you let the simulation run long enough. Equilibrium will be achieved, at least temporarily, to guarantee the survival of the group. You know what I mean? Now, once we have been in those types of societies long enough, we were able to come up with the idea of the market, essentially, which, interestingly enough, I don't think existed so much between individuals at first, and it came about more because of states. I will say that much. States came along the idea of markets because to them, the risk is arguably greater than between two individuals. Because instead of it being me and you getting into a dispute over who gets what and devolving into violence, if it becomes into what country gets what, that's a lot more violence, you know. And they both have populations that they have to stave off internal violence as well as external violence. So they have a more complicated problem than a bunch of individuals trying to get along with one another. And so the market was kind of a way that everyone was like, why don't we just deal with this peacefully? Because war is worse than fighting, you know? So what I'm trying to get at is, could we, ANCAPs, I would say, put the market in the center of all human interaction, essentially. They view the market as the ultimate mediator between people. And they view it as good because it doesn't need to be directed. It doesn't actually take a person to uphold the system. Everyone equally buys in and to the system. And it's great because no one's being forced to do anything. We voluntarily participate. And it doesn't matter. And we can choose to leave at any time or participate. But most people, by the fact of nature, want to be alive, and so now we will enter into the market to do our business. And that's, I guess, what I'm talking about when I say we may. Do you think it is possible that we could move towards that type of society where we don't necessarily need to fear for our individual survival anymore? So the types of behaviors that were necessary at that time aren't necessary anymore? Or do you think we will reach a time when they really aren't necessary and they will become, I don't know, I forget the name for a feature of a being that is no longer necessary, but it still exists as kind of a biological leftover.
Oh, vestigial.
Yeah, will that become a vestigial behavior, caring for other human beings, and because it is no longer necessary, because in the same way that we used to? Or do you think we've always kind of expressed the market from that psychological desire?
Well, yeah, I think it depends on how you define caring. You know, I don't know.
Well, at this point, we're getting really into the weeds on human psychology. Yes. and we're not psychologists.
Nope.
So, you know, because, I mean, we could placate all day about, well, I think human beings don't ever selflessly care about anything. We always selfishly care about things.
Yep.
So why would I ever help another person? Because I see them as a potential resource. And you can do that without intending to rule them, you know.
Right. Well, and I think very few people are so cynical to actually see situations that way, even if really the underpinnings of that are exactly that.
Right.
You know, there's something to be said from an evolutionary biological point of view about that's exactly why that type of social interaction developed, is because people are resources to you. Other people are resources to you, and people who felt a need to help other people were better off
because they had access to more resources.
Exactly. Almost nobody thinks of other people like that. Basically, sociopaths think about other people that way, and that's about it.
Right. But the consequence could be the same even if you don't think of it that way.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. That's the thing about evolutionary biology is we always talk about it in terms of like wanting and how we view things, but that's not those are technical terms for how things happen to play out, not the actual intentions behind them.
Exactly. But I do think we went wrong when we attached intentions to them. And that's where I'm going to pick on religions, especially, is that things just always kind of happen this way, and we feel driven to do these things. And now let's attach an attention to it, an intention to it, and then dictate it. Because, and this is a whole other topic, but humans love to dictate to themselves things they already want to do anyway, and as a form of self-fulfilling prophecy. So it's like, you should help people, and that makes you a good person. Oh, well, I already wanted to help people. Now I feel good because I'm a good person. It's like, you would have done it anyway. And anybody who needs a religion to be a good person isn't a good person in that case. And I know we're throwing around super generic subjective terms here, but I think the gist of what I'm trying to say makes common sense. Another subjective term.
Ooh. Common sense doesn't exist.
That's true. But I guess taking this all the way back to our original example, do you think the concept of a non-intervention belief in a society is possible to achieve?
Yes, but I'm not sure if we will be able to achieve it in a way that we want to. Like, because I could think of a hypothetical situation in which it is illegal to intervene. And this is enforced very strictly and punished very harshly. And so now everyone literally fears intervention. Because it, like, even like, and we could say that there is no way to justify in the court your act of intervention. The mere act of intervention itself is illegal, no matter what the outcome was.
Well, you essentially would criminalize escalation at that point.
Basically. Yeah, regardless of the intent, regardless of the outcome. And so you'd see a lot less of it at the very least, if not none of it. I could foresee that happening. I'm not sure that's what anyone wants to happen, but you could do it that way. I don't know if we can get past the psychology of it without some sort of incentive like that.
Okay, let me raise you a situation then. Okay, I'm going to cite a common saying, which is, it's just a saying, but it comes from somewhere, you know. People, in order to get ahead in life, the most successful people have to step on somebody else. Like, that's kind of
an adage, maybe?
An adage, yeah, maybe is a word for that. But do you think that if, for example, we enshrined a free market as something that we would, like a truly free market, totally unregulated, that people, the environment then we create for people would incentivize, could we create an environment without law that incentivized people to not intervene in things that would be, because you could also make the argument that by intervening, you are wasting resources. You can make that argument, especially if you are like let's go back to our example in the bar. You do decide to intervene, but you're the only one who decides to intervene. Everyone else is like, you're an idiot for intervening, and you'll feel that social pressure that you are in the wrong.
Well, yeah, and we definitely do have that, and we can experience that already when you're the only one who stands up for something, and you look around and no one else is standing up for it, and you just kind of, and you sit back down.
Yeah, you cringe hard and you sit, you know, and I feel like that's already kind of happening a lot, you know, and one example I'll give is, I think it only takes a few instances of wrongful intervention to deter even what people might today consider to be righteous intervention. I'm going to cite the Colorado bakery incident. People intervened and said, you should have to bake that cake for that guy. That guy is way better off because the people intervened, whereas the people intervened are seeing exactly the opposite of what they want to happen. Another good example, Chick-fil-A. It's just a restaurant. And yes, because of the merits of their cheap yet delicious chicken, apparently, they were a good business before. But then when people attempted to intervene on the behalf of others who they felt were being wronged, Chick-fil-A has been in better business than ever because of negative coverage of them. People come out and say, essentially, well, I think it's wrong that you are trying to intervene on something that you have no business in. And I don't know if that's because people are picking sides necessarily, but I think it goes to show that a lot of this activism that people will do nowadays to, which nowadays, this has always kind of been a thing, but it's very easy to do nowadays thanks to the internet. Anytime, a lot of the times nowadays we see when people try to intervene and implement some form of social justice against what they believe to be the perpetrator.
Let's call it what it is, a smear campaign.
A smear campaign. People tend to come out in favor of the smeared. And this could be its own instance of hyperbolic circumstance where the people who come out in favor of the smeared see that anytime anything is smeared, it is wrong. And so they'll take the side of whoever is being smeared. And they see that as right, you know. But, and that's not so much.
Well, because it's very easy to see someone on the wrong end of a smear campaign. Even if that side really is in the wrong, it's easy to see them as a victim to a bully.
Yes.
Because when a bunch of people get up and start, you know, like, okay, if someone does something really bad, and a bunch of people find out about it, and they start trying to get that person fired, people still feel bad for the person who's going to get fired.
Yeah.
Because they feel like he's being bullied.
And that bullying is escalation. Interference.
Yes.
But I don't think it's unanimous necessarily yet. Another example is the get woke, go broke phenomena, which is when people who have no business, it is not their role in society that people feel to weigh in on certain issues, specifically faceless corporations. You know? I'm going to make a stance. It's like people don't like that. And people don't like it either way, you know, on either side of an issue.
Well, right. Because no one wants their favorite ice cream company telling them how to think about politics.
Exactly.
Nobody wants that.
Nobody wants that. And I don't care if you're saying things that I agree with. It's like, why are you telling me about this? I want some ice cream. That's all I want. stop complicating your product.
Well, you know? Well, right. And I could even think of it, you know, one step removed from that. When I'm eating your ice cream in front of my friends, I don't want my friends bringing up your political campaign to talk to me about it. I just want to enjoy some ice cream.
Exactly. So by you trying to intervene in a discussion about something that is outside the realm of what we think you should be doing, you're going to suffer for it. You know, I think that might be the driver that we could use to eventually move to a place where it, any intervention is seen as unnecessary. Granted, on the grand social level, it's a lot more disconnected and disjointed, and the human psychological necessity to help other people doesn't invoke as much when it's a Twitter page or a company, because they're not people in front of you. But I think these types of behaviors trickle down, if you will. They do, I think. They propagate down from what we consider to be just an institution to individual behavior. And I do think they can go the other way, obviously, because it has to start with somebody. But I do think we might see in the future people who unprovoked get involved in anything. And you can already see it in most workplaces. If I walk up to a coworker whom I just work with and don't know outside of work at all and start talking about politics, most people, even if they agree with me, will not want to interact with me anymore, because it's like, why are you talking about that at work? That's inappropriate. And I think, you know, this could lead to another good discussion about the separation of the public and the private life. That's another thing that gets talked a lot about in libertarian circles that I think would be worth our time going into. But that's a good example of how that concept of separation of self and society is invoked and could be invoked to discourage the type of interventionist behavior or the escalatory behavior. Because I think that anytime people get involved, especially in a hyperbolic circumstance, anyone outside of that circumstance will want nothing to do with it, or you know, because it's, you know, what is it called? It's easier to see it from the outside looking in a lot of the time. And, you know, this also could easily dovetail into a conversation about echo chambers as well. That's another way that people can help encourage themselves into a hyperbolic circumstance in which they're attempting to escalate a situation which no one has even escalated to begin with, you know. But everyone outside looking in on it. And this is why I do think that having free, open discussions about these things and us being able to comment openly about them helps propagate that idea. And I do think that's a good thing. I do think if we could reach a place where no one intervened, in a place where they didn't feel they had to, and if we could get that to be the place where I'm not going to intervene unless I hold personal responsibility in this, we would be way better off. Now that we have a system like a market and we've moved towards a place where we don't have to, the way by which we distribute human effort does not need to be as finely tuned as it used to be. And that's a whole other discussion about why is it that less than 100 years ago, 90% of the world's population were farmers, and now less than 10% are, you know. Those market forces have huge ramifications for how we behave as a society that we are not going to be able to just make ourselves change to. You know, the human psychology does not grow with technology, and that's something we've also talked about, but I do think that's a worthwhile discussion to have as well. So, well, we're at time, and I think that's a good place to leave it, because we've kind of frayed that end to be able to go to many different places. And we didn't so much talk too much about the hyperbolic circumstance itself. I think we might end up talking about this episode for more what it really was, and that's a discussion on escalation, you know, the maybe not morality of escalation, but just an observation on escalation. So, do you have anything else you want to contribute to that?
I don't think so.
Okay, well, philosophers.
Philosophers.